Exactly. And sometimes when a child, for example, he hits his parents and he sees their parents, they have no response and they don't know how to deal with it. And then he will start to do that always. So we're saying do not make sure you don't give them either a weak spot or weakness.
Right. And on that note, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're discussing why a parent shouldn't show weak points to their children because the children may then abuse and manipulate these weak points. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So we're saying these examples of being weak in front of our kids, it's so many that sometimes we don't pay attention to them. We take them, you know, as lightly and... we get over it. The problem is this, it does not leave them, it just grows with them. Maybe they don't cry when they get older, but right. They will be more stubborn. Okay, for example, right. You could have someone who's 11, 12, or even older, right? The mother could ask him to eat food. She's like, no, I'm playing. I'll finish play and come.
Right.
And he's like, no, you have to eat now. So you do your work, you need to relax. And then he's like, in the day when he was a kid, he used to scream out and cry.
Right.
Now he can just raise his voice, like, no. He's like raising his voice and, you know, rejecting his mom.
Right.
And obviously she doesn't want to get into that issue with her son. He's like, sure, fine, just keep quiet.
Just leave him be.
Yeah.
It's not so important anyway.
I've seen this with so many kids. The minute, I've seen it with, even boys at the age of 20. Like, they yell at their moms. It's like, I don't want to eat now, right? I'll eat later. Save my food. And the mother has to shut his mouth.
Right.
She's like, okay, sure, okay. You know? And she just gives up. So we said that when it comes to matters of weakness, we have to be very careful. Otherwise, we could be doing something that, you know, that end up being devastating to the child himself, like something that will definitely... grow up with him.
And then if you want to fix this weak point that you have yourself have created in the situation, you're going to have to escalate dramatically to prevent the child
even
from doing this.
Well, that's a problem. Even if you fix your weak spot yourself, the child has already adopted a method.
Right.
Okay, for example, that the child that cries constantly if he doesn't get what he wants, so you've been giving him. Now he said, you know what? No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to give him anymore. Now his crying will intensify.
Right, yeah. Okay? The situation escalates from
both
parts.
It escalates even worse. So you haven't achieved anything. Therefore, we say you have to be from the beginning, be careful and mindful. Because sometimes it's going to be very long process to try and cure that.
Extremely difficult.
So and you will need a lot of patience too. For example, if you can't put up with him crying or he's screaming for a couple of seconds, imagine him doing it for an hour.
Right.
And kids have that. Yeah, and kids have that mentality to go like this. They have this arrogance to continue for such a long time.
They can focus single-handedly on one thing and stick with it.
That's it. Well, that's how kids were.
Right.
That's what makes them kids being kids. So as parents, like I said, one of the obstacles that we face sometimes is that we are too weak. Either we are too gentle, either we are too emotional. We are too attached. We give them what they want. We spoil them too much, and they find that weakness.
But just a note for our listeners: being emotional is a good thing. It just do not let these emotions create a hold that your child has over you. Right?
Exactly. No. So, for example, my children, they know I love them very much.
Right.
They know I'm a very emotional person with them as well, but they know that these tricks don't work on me.
Right. Right.
So no matter how much my son tries, no matter how hard he tries to get away with something, he knows he just can't do it.
Right.
So he just gives up. Dad, I'm like, no.
Doesn't work on me.
No, doesn't work.
Right. And with that, dear Sayyid, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Ya Muqiyya al-Khayran, Ya The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how children... Today we are discussing why parents shouldn't let their children have any leverage by showing them weak points. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
Therefore, when we try to look at ourselves and make sure that we are the best parents and the best educators out there, and like, mind you, this doesn't always, it just doesn't happen with parents, it happens with teachers as well. Teachers have to face the same problem when they have like bullies in the class and they have rude kids in the class and or the rich kids in the class, they can't do much too. So they end up also submitting to their will.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, and so what we, when we try to remove these obstacles, like I always say, not only the benefit goes to the father, but the child does well, because we have a law in Siyam and fasting. It says that if you're sick and you know your fasting will prolong your sickness, then
make
you
it worse.
Then it's haram for you to fast.
Right.
So you should not be fasting. So the same thing here is that sometimes you have to look at, now it might be a good thing to do to, I don't know, to control a child, keep a child quiet, or get him to, you know, to get away from you. But it might seem good at the time, but you have to look at the consequences of such an action on the long run.
You need to think
long
term.
You just open the door, as we say, you open the door to Pandora's box.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So we have a hadith from the Prophet, he says, إِذَا قَدَّمْتَ عَلَىٰ أَمْرٍ فَتَدَبَّرْ عَاقِبَتَهُ. If you come to do an action, look at the consequences. فَإِنْ كَانَ خَيْرًا فَأَقْبَلْ. If it's good, do it. فَإِنْ كَانَ شَرًّا, no, hold, hit the brakes and stop. So with your child, it's the same. Like, how you deal with them, they are, you know, like, you know, with robots these days, they have this AI system where they just look and learn as they go. This is a child, basically. He has that moment, he just looks and just saves information in his brain. And so if from a young age, he finds out these loopholes, that will continue. And sometimes you have people who are old enough, they still manage to manipulate and abuse their parents because of that. That fact, you know, for example, they know their mom doesn't say much. So even as a as an adult, not even a child, not even a teenager, adults, for example, they go steal from their moms because he knows his mom's not going to do anything. You know, she's too soft.
There's no consequence.
Yeah, it's like, what is
and
she going to do?
Still continue on loving me and continuing like normal.
So they end up stealing from them. They end up doing a lot of bad stuff, and you know, their safeguard, they go back to their mom. So for example, I remember when I was a kid, my mom was very soft. If someone that's trying to get angry and with me, I run to my mom, and that's it.
Right, it's a safe haven.
Yeah, it's a safe haven, and my mom used to do that. But then I think at some stage that said to her, "Okay, that shouldn't work anymore.
Right.
You know, don't do that." Then my mom was like, "No, go to your dad."
Right, yeah.
However, you did, you have to face it. Then I had to find a new method of trying to find my dad's weakness, and I did. By the way,
you did.
I did, and I found his weakness is his prayer mat. If I am in the prayer mat, he can't hit me. And so as a child, you're constantly working to find a way weak spot.
Little devils.
So now he always constantly has his prayer mat open, his turba and his books. I go on the prayer mat, that's it, that's my embassy.
Church
cannot
me.
Reach me.
I dare you.
Yeah, yeah. So as kids, we don't want to do that. We have to make sure that this obstacle is removed.
As parents, you mean?
Yeah, as parents.
Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your lecture. It has been very insightful, and inshallah, I myself and our dear listeners will reap lots of benefits from this information. We will unfortunately have to end today's program. I thank you for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions, comments, or just some feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. We also have social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Take care.
Do you know what Islam's It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at humanity from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. One of the issues that we have when it comes to family is the right of children, and to be specific, when it comes to his right financially. And today we gave it a call, we gave it a name under the title of child support. Now, child support might be a new concept in the secular system, in the so-called advanced world, but in fact, that is not new to us as Muslims. Where Islam has established the right of a child to financial advantages even before these systems think of it, over 1,000 years, that system been established in Islam. Now, with children, because they have special needs and because they cannot work and defend and do things for themselves, so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made it a requirement that we need to take of our children, and we need to make sure that they are fed, clothed, and that they have enough money for their survival. Now, we see this happens a lot when we have divorces, where one of the parents neglects his job to pay for his child, especially when it comes to the man himself. And most of the times, as we see in these secular systems that we live in, one has to resort to going to court, or the woman has to resort to going to court to seek child support for her kids, where the father says, well, you know, with me no longer, then I don't see myself, you know, liable to pay for you or your child. Now, that's just a wrong mentality. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says that one must maintain and take care of his kids. Now, having said that, it is a matter of child support is a very sensitive issue. One of the problems that we face, especially in the secular system, is that give women so much rights over a man, more than obviously what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has dictated. Now Allah says, when it comes to the child himself, his well-being and his care and his maintenance and, you know, finances and everything in between is in fact the duty of the father. So the father has what we call the duty of care for his children. So he must be providing for his child, considering that the child is under his protection. So if the father is fine and, you know, logically he's okay, financially he's okay, then the mother has no business in taking that child from his dad, because he is the one who needs to maintain him. That's the law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, if we look at it in depth, well, we do say that child at a certain age stays with his mother, a girl at a certain age stays with her mother, but then they have to go back to the father. He's the one that needs to maintain them. If we break that chain, or the chain of command, of chain of sequence, chains of laws, then the system falls apart. Let us take a break and we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, and we are looking at the rights of a child when it comes to his finances. So we did say that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayh, in a saying that seems to be a bit controversial, and that he says, قِلَّةِ الْعِيَالِ أَحَدُ الْيَسَارِ, that if you do find yourself financially not capable to bring children and to have children and maintain them and sustain them, then you should not. That's what the hadith says. It says one of the easy ways to, you know, in life is to have less kids. So if you have one, two kids, three kids, maybe more is not in your advantage, not for you, but for the kids themselves. Because we do see in so many countries with parents who have too many kids, they keep bringing them into life without knowing how to maintain them and how to take care of them. And most of the times, these kids end up being in the streets, these kids being orphans, or these kids being homeless, or what have you. And then, because of this, we had systems in place to even prevent people from having children in the first place. So we go into both extremes here. So we have, in some countries, birth control, where you've been told what you can and cannot have. For example, in some countries, you're only allowed to have one child. For example, in China, in some countries, may be allowed to have two, and so on and so forth. And you see, in certain countries, they might, you know, trying to propagate abortion and make it legal, and so on and so forth. If we went by the Islamic system, we wouldn't have these problems to begin with. So when one has too much kids, obviously he will find himself unable to sustain them. Now, we're not saying that one should not have children or one should, you know, limit himself to one or two, children. No, have as much as you can, considering the fact that you can maintain them, you can care of them. Because sometimes you say, Allah will provide. Surely Allah will provide. But Allah will provide for those who think, for those who contemplate, not for those who do not think. When we look at some countries and we see so many kids in the streets and kids even being dragged into army and gangs and what have you, because the parents, they had no system in place. They don't know what to do with their kids. If you are financially very well off, if you have a house, you have everything else, and you know you want to have kids, by all means. But unless you have these things in place, then it's going to be a calamity, like Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi said. So the child himself has a responsibility, has a right that need to be maintained by his parents. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
In the limelight. For those who spend their days operating within the constraints of empirical reality, the long-running voter fraud scam peddled by right-wing con artists poses a dilemma. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jesse Wegman, a member of the editorial board of the New York Times. He's also the author of the book Let the People Pick the President, the case for abolishing the Electoral College. The article is titled, Surprise, There's No Voter Fraud Again. For those who spend their days operating within the constraints of empirical reality, the long-running voter fraud scam peddled by right-wing con artists poses a dilemma. Respond to their claims and give them the veneer of legitimacy that they crave, or ignore them and risk letting transparent lies spread unchecked. I used to err on the side of responding as often as possible, in the belief that persistent fact-checking and debunking was the best way to inoculate the American public against a virulent campaign of deception. But it became clear to me, probably later than it should have, that this was always a fool's game. The professional vote fraud crusaders are not in the fact business. While they pretend to care about real election crimes, their purpose is not to identify whether voters are actually committing such crimes. It is to concoct a world in which the votes of certain people, and it always seems to be the same people, are presumptively invalid. That's why they're not chastened by data demonstrating, again and again and again, that there is essentially no voter fraud anywhere in this country. Thanks to their efforts, about three-quarters of Republicans believe the 2020 presidential election was stolen, and they won't be convinced by evidence to the contrary. That evidence continues to grow. Earlier this week, the Associated Press released an impressively thorough report examining every potential case of voter fraud in six decisive battleground states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, where Donald Trump and his allies challenged the result in 2020. Voters in these six states cast a combined 25.5 million votes for president last year and chose Joe Biden over Donald Trump by 311,257 votes. The total number of possible cases of fraud, the Associated Press found, well, fewer than 475, or 0.15% of Joe Biden's margin of victory in those states. Many of those cases the Associated Press identified turned out not to be fraud at all. Some involved a poll worker's error or a voter's innocent confusion, such as the Trump supporter in Wisconsin who mistakenly thought he could vote while on parole. "The guy upstairs knows what I did," the man said after a court appearance. "I didn't have any intention to commit election fraud." In the few instances of clear fraud, for example, a Pennsylvania man who cast two ballots, one for himself and later in disguise, one for his son, local authorities were quick to act. In Arizona, officials investigated 198 cases of potential fraud, most involving double voting. They invalidated virtually all of the second votes and have so far charged 9 people with voting fraud crimes. That's the thing about voter fraud. Not only is it rare, it's generally easy to catch, especially if it happens on a large scale. In 2019, North Carolina officials ordered a do-over of a congressional election after the winning candidate's campaign was found to have financed an illegal voter turnout effort. That candidate was a Republican, as were 2 of 3 residents of The Villages, a Florida retirement community who were arrested and charged with double voting in the 2020 presidential election earlier this month. The third had no party affiliation. Given how much the Republicans bang on about the dangers of voter fraud, a little schadenfreude is in order here. But it misses the bigger point. To the extent there is any fraud, it is almost entirely an individual phenomena. The Associated Press report confirmed this, finding no evidence anywhere of a coordinated effort to commit voter fraud. That's no surprise. Committing a single case of fraud is hard enough. Doing so as part of a conspiracy is essentially impossible, once you consider how many people would need to be in on the scheme. "It's a staggeringly inefficient way to affect an outcome," said David Daley, the author of Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. It simply doesn't work. To sum up once more, for the folks in the cheap seats, voter fraud is vanishingly rare. It is virtually never coordinated. And when it does happen, it is often easily discovered and prosecuted by the authorities. I hold no illusions that any of these truths will matter to those who have invested themselves in tales of widespread voter fraud. After all, they weren't moved when both Republican and Democratic officials in states around the country reaffirmed, in some cases multiple times, the accuracy and integrity of their vote counts. Even Bill Barr, the former Attorney General and one of Donald Trump's most reliable bootlickers, could not bring himself to repeat the lie that there was any meaningful fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Alas, Republican voters don't listen to Bill Barr. They listen to Donald Trump, who dismissed the Associated Press's report by doing his standard Mafia Don impression. "I just don't think you should make a fool out of yourself by saying 400 votes," the former president told the news organization, insisting that the true number of fraudulent votes in 2020 was in the, quote, hundreds of thousands, unquote. But what is Donald Trump's evidence? An unreleased report by a source that he refuses to name. This is how it goes with the vote fraud fraudsters. The damning evidence is always right around the next corner, or the one after that. recalled that Donald Trump established a voter fraud commission soon after he entered office, with the goal of rooting out the supposedly massive fraud that led him to lose the popular vote by nearly 3 million votes. Like everyone else, he knew that true democratic legitimacy comes not from the Electoral College, but rather from a majority of the American people. The commission was led by Kris Kobach, the indefatigable vote fraud warrior whom Mr. Daley once called an Inspector Clouseau who gazes into his mirror and seeks Sherlock Holmes. In Kris Kobach's previous job as Kansas's Secretary of State, he spent years hunting for widespread vote fraud and won only 9 convictions, most of them of older Republican men who had double voted. Under Kris Kobach's leadership, the Trump Voter Fraud Commission disbanded after less than a year of chaos and controversy without having made any findings. That's because, as the Associated Press report affirms once again, there was nothing to find. American voters aren't cheating, and certainly not in any coordinated way. And here lies the deepest irony of this strange, fragile moment we're living in. A very real threat is, in fact, looming over America's electoral integrity. But it's not coming from voters. It's coming from the people braying the loudest about the importance of election integrity. Donald Trump turned fact-free charges of voter fraud into an art form, but the exploitation of the predictable public fear generated by that sort of rhetoric has been a central feature of the Republican playbook for years. Back in 2013, the then North Carolina lawmaker, Thorne Tillis, explained why Republicans in the legislature were passing their strict voter ID law. There is some evidence of voter fraud, but that's not the primary reason for doing this, said Mr. Tillis, now a U.S. senator. There are a lot of people who are just concerned with the potential risk of fraud. Why are they so concerned? Because their leaders have been feeding them a steady diet of lies. That diet became an all-you-can-eat buffet in the Trump years, culminating in the Stop the Steal rallies after the 2020 presidential election, and then, horrifically, in the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol. Now, the same people who subscribe to the lies about election fraud are running for, and often winning, jobs overseeing the running of elections across the country. They are representative of a new generation of Republicans, raised in the fever swamps of Fox News and other purveyors of disinformation, who believe elections are valid only when their candidate wins. The goal of the Voter Fraud Brigade, it turns out, was never to identify fraud that might have happened in the past. Rather, it was to indoctrinate voters with the terror of stolen elections and to pave the way for a hostile takeover of American democracy in the future.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Morgan, Helen Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. They're really there's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of centrists, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire.
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does, and of course I take personal responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year, amid the first nationwide lockdown. Obviously, the Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Inflation in the UK has risen to its highest level in 10 years. The cost of living has surged by 5.1% in the 12 months to November, up from 4.2% the month before. This was the steepest increase for a decade, and more than doubles the central bank's target. Increase in costs for fuel, energy, clothing, and secondhand cars were indicative of the rise in inflation. Economists had expected an inflation of 4.7% for the month of November, and the Bank of England had projected that inflation would hit 5% in the spring of 2022, before moderating towards its 2% target in late 2023.
We haven't seen inflation at this level for many decades. The highest level I can remember actually was back in the 1970s when it reached 25%. So 5% is still very high, but nothing near that level. But it's still double the level that the Bank of England expects, of just over about 2.5%. And so it's going to be very difficult to try and adjust to it. Now, the question is, of course, is this going to be embedded inflation and carried on, as we saw in the 1970s, or is it just rolled off after 12 months because of individual price increases?
It is believed that global supply chain problems, staff shortages, and rapid demand for oil and gas have all driven up prices. The end of COVID support schemes and Brexit have also played a part. In November, petrol prices jumped to the highest ever recorded, while the cost of used cars jumped due to shortages of new vehicles. The UK fuel poverty has further increased due to the increase in energy costs, putting further strain on the average UK family.
And those supply chain issues take a long time to work their way through. Most recently we had, for instance, a shortage of lorry drivers, and only now we're beginning to see our way through the other side of that. So that's taken 3 or 4 months to work its way through. Other issues of supply chain will be much longer. as a lot of businesses will try and shorten their supply routes, supply chains, and de-risk their supply chains, and that means more localization, local product production, and maybe less trade coming out of, say, the Far East and other areas like that. So global trade was designed in such a way, it was like an elastic band, very efficient and very taut, but unfortunately when that elastic band breaks, it's very difficult to replace quickly.
The rising inflation has sparked an outcry from Britain's Unite Trade Union. It says many workers face an effective pay cut with the prospect of below-inflation annual wage increases. The Unite Union has urged companies to grant pay hikes that preserve the buying power salary.
Well, what we've seen, obviously, is of price rising, particularly gas. And unfortunately for the British public, they've got a nasty shock coming in the spring when the government-imposed cap on the gas price is taken off. And a lot of people see their prices of gas nearly double in value, which is going to be very painful for them indeed. So this is working its way through the system. We're going to see higher wage rises coming through. And this has particularly hit people at the weaker end of society, those who are poorer paid. Well, if nothing else, it means they're going to get paid more. But unfortunately, not in real terms, because even if you get a 4% pay rise, which has been suggested for many, when you've got inflation at over 5%, you're still losing money.
Current estimates suggest that costs for the typical UK family will jump by £1,700 in the year 2022. But Labour claimed the government is not doing nearly enough to tackle the problem, especially as further inflationary pressures from rising energy costs are coming down the line. Omicron, which emerged late last month, forced Britain to reimpose coronavirus restrictions that were passed by lawmakers late on Tuesday. The UK economy was already struggling prior to the arrival of Omicron, growing by 0.1% in October from 0.6% in September. The International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday that new COVID-19 variants pose downside risks to the outlook for Britain, urging the government to consider new emergency stimulus measures in the event of fresh lockdowns. The IMF predicted inflation would reach around 5.5% early next year, its highest in 30 years, and warned the bank not to succumb to inaction bias. Economists have warned that the supply chain disruptions will continue to disrupt economic activity, leading to sharp price increases at least for the year 2022. This phenomenon is not unique to just the UK. The US and many other parts of the world are also suffering from inflation, from food prices to energy costs.
After a chaotic end to its disastrous war in Afghanistan, failure of America's longest military mission is fueling a heated debate about U.S. militarism. The war dragged on for two decades and cost American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called war on terror, launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout, with the Taliban back in power, is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight, was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. It was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means for subduing the Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
Many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? and what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades. Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond. The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decades, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting, and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
We can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment, and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli prime minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interests of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE. They don't care about the people of Palestine. And they don't care about the Arab. They certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ibrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria, almost. And they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, is now warning that the presence of Israel in the Persian Gulf region will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as the root cause of problems in the region. Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
What did Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham say about the 6th of January rioting at the United States Capitol? And when did they say it? Were they suitably censorious of the violence? At the time, did their public remarks match their private horror? The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Frank Bruni, a contributing opinion writer with more than 25 years' experience. The article is titled, "The Line from Fox News to Trump's Big Lie is Short and Direct." Did Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham say about the 6th of January rioting at the United States Capitol? And when did they say it? Were they suitably censorious of the violence? At the time, did their public remarks match their private horror? Those questions have been heatedly and extensively hashed out over the days since the House Committee released text messages from 6th of January, in which Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, the popular host of primetime shows on Fox News, separately implored President Donald Trump's chief of staff to get Donald Trump to say and do something to disperse the protesters and quell the violence. Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham knew that he had stirred those protesters and could sway them, more so than they ever acknowledged on air, according to their critics. According to Hannity and Ingraham, they're just the victims, yet again, of left-wing media sneers. You can delve into the weeds of this, or you can pull back and survey the whole ugly yard. And what you see when you do that, what matters most in the end, is that Fox News has helped to sell the fiction that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. And there's a direct line from that lie to the rioting. There's a direct line from that lie to various Republicans' attempts to develop mechanisms to overturn vote counts should they dislike the election results. That lie is the root of the terrible danger that we're in, with Donald Trump's supporters being encouraged to distrust and undermine the democratic process. And that lie has often found a welcome mat at Fox News. The Washington Post media critic Eric Wemple is among the many attuned observers who have documented this, and a column of his from mid-January 2021 presented a compendium of inciting commentary on Fox News Channel in the lead-up to 6th of January. Interviewing Donald Trump on 29th of November 2020, the Fox business host, Maria Bartiromo, declared, "We cannot allow America's election to be corrupted. We cannot." On Sean Hannity's show just 2 days later, the Fox News host, Jeanine Pirro, vented an apocalyptic outrage about Joe Biden's election victory, saying, "This fraud will continue and America will be doomed for the next 20 years. The Fox News contributor Newt Gingrich, the Fox business host Lou Dobbs, Sean Hannity himself, all of them got in on the action to some degree or other, stating or signaling that something about the 2020 presidential election was terribly amiss. But where is their evidence? It was fugitive then, and no one has tracked it down since. That's because it doesn't exist. It's a conspiracy-minded, ratings-driven hallucination. Just this week, the Associated Press published a review of every potential case of voter fraud in the 6 battleground states where Donald Trump has disputed Joe Biden's victory. It found fewer than 475 cases. Joe Biden won Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.